gentlemen, when the Russian Tsar Nicholas I died in 1855, the tart-tongued Slavophile Alexei Chomyakov, when asked by a friend to assess Nicholas' reign, said, "Well, the problem is it was all a mistake." Some Soviets, Mikhail Gorbachev amongst them, I think made a similar assessment about the long tenure in office of Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev, who died in 1982 after 18 years at the helm of the party. Like Stalin, however, Brezhnev could make certain claims on historical memory. He could point out that under his tutelage, the Soviet defense industry and the Soviet army had made real progress in addressing the military imbalance against which the Soviets had always struggled with the West. And in fact, he could claim probably, realistically and objectively, by the end of his life, that the Soviet Union had achieved military parity with the West and perhaps even a measure of military superiority. Think about weapons. Submarines, carriers, the Soviet Union was supplied in this area, although perhaps not quite to the extent that the American arsenal was. In terms of tanks and conventional weaponry, the Soviets were far superior in the 80s or early 80s. It is probably the case that in terms of sheer megatonnage, remember the days when we used to talk about megatonnage and the Washington Post and New York Times used to worry about that. In terms of sheer megatonnage, probably the Soviet arsenal was more powerful than the American arsenal. I'm not an expert, but this is simply my impression. At the very least, the Soviets were very powerful. The Brezhnev regime managed, in the wake of the Czechoslovak intervention in 1968, to assert that it would not countenance any kind of Western intervention in its sphere of influence. And this doctrine, by which it lived till the end of the Brezhnev period, the so-called Brezhnev Doctrine, this doctrine was accepted, I think, faute de mieux, simply as a statement of fact by Western powers. In 1975, at Helsinki, Brezhnev and Soviet diplomats achieved something that had eluded the Soviet Union for 30 years. Namely, they got a treaty that fixed the borders of Eastern European nations and the Soviet Union in such a way as to be recognized by the Western powers. And this was, let us remember from the Soviet perspective at the time, a very great achievement, because up until that point, the Soviets had suffered under the impression, the rightful impression, that the non-recognition by the West of their borders was problematic from the point of view of Soviet security interests in the long run. And then remember that under Brezhnev, Soviet power was asserted in some pretty far corners of the world, in Africa, in Ethiopia, for example, in the Horn, in Angola, in the civil war there, a good deal of military assistance was given directly by the Soviets and then indirectly through the Soviet Union's Cuban ally. In Afghanistan, in 1979, there began an ill-fated war, but it was at its inception, I think, a war of hubris. The Soviet leadership was not going to permit on its borders what Ronald Reagan called a reversal, that is, a socialist state, at least a nominally socialist regime, being removed from power and some ideologically hostile regime put in its place. This would set a bad precedent. So Brezhnev could make claims on history. Soviet Union was a great state. It was perhaps the most powerful state in the world, and everybody had to respect it for its power. But underneath the surface, the rot had set in. Dissenters like Andrei Sakharov, Solzhenitsyn, and others had a surprising amount of latitude. Remember that from 1962, when Solzhenitsyn published One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, till he was expelled in 1974 from the Soviet Union, he wasn't arrested by the authorities. Remember that Sakharov came public with his dissent against Soviet military policy as early as 1968, and also came public with an assertion that there should be greater intellectual freedom. By 1975, Sakharov could write in a book, My Country and the World, that Soviet system has much to learn from the capitalist systems of the West, and he even pressed a variant of a theory called convergence, that in the future the two hostile social systems, socialism and capitalism, would learn from one another and there would emerge eventually a civilization on both sides of the ideological divide that was more advanced and more humane and more democratic and liberal. Sakharov was not arrested for the assertion of these sentiments. And even when he publicly formed a body that investigated human rights violations in the Soviet Union under provisions of the Helsinki Treaty that I mentioned before, the so-called Third Basket Agreement, Sakharov was not touched by the Soviet authorities. So dissent became possible. It was never comfortable, but it became possible. At the top, people were very concerned about their privileges, their material privileges. The revolutionary steam had got out of the Bolsheviks. Lots of jokes about this. Brezhnev taking his mother to the Kremlin and saying, you see this, you see that. She says, it's all wonderful, Leonia, but what if the Reds come back? What if? You have to think about that joke for a while, but I can guarantee it's an authentic Russian joke, an anecdote of the time. Below the surface, what I'm getting at is a kind of atrophy of true belief. If you look at the first generations of Soviet politicians, Lenin and Trotsky, Stalin, even Khrushchev, you find that here were true believers in the socialist cause. Lenin was famously ascetic. Dzerzhinsky, the first head of the Cheka, famously ascetic. That is to say, these people live simple lives. The ultimate aphrodisiac was ideology and power. Stalin was more, let us say, extravagant in his personal manner. He certainly lived well by virtue of his position, but he never sought after large spaces or personal gain. The only thing that he loved, and people tell you this in memoir after memoir, the only thing he loved was power, and of course himself. Khrushchev has been described by my colleague Andrzej Walicki, who's very perceptive on such matters. He's been described as the last real communist. In other words, even at the top of the leadership, a certain something under Brezhnev had disappeared. The ideological fervor wasn't there. The concern about the purity of socialism wasn't there. What had replaced it was pride in the achievement of the Soviet Union. What had replaced it was a happiness at the material benefits that were available to the party elite and to the privileges that were possible. You know, Brezhnev accepted a Lincoln Continental from Richard Nixon. Nixon was a brilliant man. He always knew the neuralgic point, the weaknesses of other politicians. Brezhnev loved to hunt, and he loved fast cars. And so Nixon once gave him rifles, and another time he gave him a Lincoln Continental. Of course, Nixon was really, amazing. He had our boys insert a bug in the limo, and when it's inevitable, we learned some things. For example, the name of Brezhnev's the masseuse that he most liked, a woman named Olga, who did wonderful things for him, apparently. When, as inevitably happened, the KGB found the bug, then somebody had fun and leaked all this to Time magazine. So anyway, the corruption and interest in material benefits was something that was widely known outside of the communist world, and it was known inside. People on the street knew that the authorities lived well, and they were self-seeking, and that they established for their children nice, cushy positions in the diplomatic institute or in government service that would enable their children to go abroad. Well, by the time that Brezhnev died in 1982, it was clear to some people in the party apparatus that something had gone out of the system, something had been lost, and the party would have to be revived, maybe reformed, certainly discipline would have to be restored. I want to talk today about various attempts to restore party discipline and to create party reform. I will say something about the brief careers as General Secretary of the party of Yuri Andropov and Konstantin Chernenko. And then at the end of the lecture, I want to say something about Mikhail Gorbachev's first years in power after 1985. I think that Andropov and Chernenko were two very unlike men. Their personalities were quite different. They had different sorts of intelligence and different political styles. But their problem was the same problem. And that was the restoration of ideological discipline, efficiency in factory life, and of a spirit that was somehow absent from the party at the time. Now, Andropov was a member of the party who had been appointed in the late 60s to be the head of the KGB. It's important for us to understand that he was a party man first. He was not like Yezhov or Beria, someone that had grown up in the security apparatus. He was a party person who was put there in order to keep the KGB under control. But for 14 or 15 years, he presided over the agency, and willy-nilly he imbibed many of the habits of mind of the agency, and probably by the end he was looking with KGB eyes, whatever those are, at the Soviet system and the rest of the world. Even before Brezhnev died, Andropov was attempting to remove him from power. And the cat's paw that was used by Andropov was an anti-corruption campaign which was aimed at party people on the take. There were some low-level targets, But we know that he was after Brezhnev because after a while it became clear that he was interested in a strange and bizarre diamond smuggling business, which involved a man who was high up in the KGB apparatus and connected to Brezhnev's daughter, Galina, and a certain figure of the Soviet circus who has the wild name of Boris the Gypsy. It seems that the circus troupe, when it went abroad, was smuggling diamonds, getting cash, and then the cash was turned into goods back in the Soviet Union, and the KGB link, a colonel in the KGB, and Brezhnev's daughter were providing political cover. Of course, Andropov knew about this, just like J. Edgar Hoover, that evil character, knew about the indiscretions of every politician in Washington. Andropov knew about this, no doubt, for a long time. But by late 81, 82, he came public because Brezhnev was physically incapacitated, because he could see that the policies he was pursuing domestically in the economic sphere were disastrous, and he wanted Brezhnev removed. And quickly after Brezhnev's death, Andropov moved to broaden the anti-corruption campaign and to remove through it other key personnel of the Brezhnev period. Now, Andropov was no dummy. He didn't go too far. He didn't touch, for example, the alter ego of Brezhnev, Konstantin Chernenko, about whom I'll talk in a moment, and certain other people, Andrei Gromyko, for example, were untouchables, and it never crossed Andropov's mind to remove them. As he removed people of Brezhnev's mafia, this patronage group that had presided over posts in the Soviet Union for so long, Andropov promoted people of a younger generation. People like Mikhail Gorbachev, who was a generation younger than Andropov, a generation younger than Brezhnev. Now, what's important about these characters that were promoted is that, for the most part, they didn't remember the struggles of the Second World War, or they remembered them only from childhood and adolescence and through a glass darkly, therefore. Gorbachev was not a veteran. He'd had brothers, older brothers, go to the front, and one of them was killed, but he himself had not seen action. And this means that these people were less manic about the buildup of defense. They were softer, if you will, and more pliable in a sense. They were recognizably more Western, in that by this time, the Western leadership was beginning to have a generational change as well. And so as the post-war generation began to come to power, you have profile of leadership that is recognizably, I think, different. This is also in Soviet in the Soviet context, a generation that first became active in party politics under Khrushchev. They remembered Stalin, but again as youthful people. When they began their major party assignments, the first one, that is in their 20s, this was already under Khrushchev. So they grew up under reformed communism. And of course, to move the Soviet Union forward, these people might be, some of them, tempted to move beyond reform communism. So Andropov, in promoting the younger generation, was promoting a different type of politician than the ones that the Soviets were so familiar with. Now, Andropov died before he could successfully reform the party in terms of making replacements, a generational replacement of personnel. But he got a start on the system. Was he, Andropov himself, a reformer? Well, you can get arguments about this. I know that when he first came to power, some pretty good American Kremlinologists described him as a liberal, or they even used the term a reformer. They talked about him reading English novels, listening to jazz, and all these sorts of superficial things. My own sense was that Andropov, in his heart, was not really a reformer. He was a tough man that had presided over the KGB. He, on his watch, had instituted the incarceration of dissidents in psychiatric asylums. This was not a pleasant person, and not a liberal in the Western sense. But he had no choice but to change the personnel in the party, and he had no choice but to move the economy forward if he could, and he chose the instrument to do this of work discipline. Now, what is work discipline in the Soviet context? Well, first thing it means is that you have to stop leaving your job in the middle of the day to shop, because that's inefficient. And you should stop drinking before you come to the office or to the factories. In other words, there was a concern about alcoholism that Andropov wanted to deal with. Both of these jaw-boning campaigns, that's really what they were, for work discipline and stopping alcoholism, failed. And it's not surprising. If you look at the reality of Soviet life, you have scarce goods of a consumer nature, scarcity of food. You could get bread any day, but you couldn't count on finding eggs or milk and so on. So it was in the self-interest of people to leave their job at 2 o'clock in the afternoon for an hour and see what was in the stores and shop. Now, that was the reality in Moscow. Now, the party could say, well, this is inefficient and you shouldn't do it, but if people were going to eat, they had very little choice. I mean, otherwise there had to be a structural change of the economy, which Andropov didn't contemplate. And I won't explain to you why the campaign against alcoholism didn't work. It's like baying at the moon. You know, you make these sounds for a certain time and people hear them, but it doesn't affect behavior very much. Andropov's campaign for work discipline, for stopping alcoholism, failed. What did happen was something of a negative sort. He didn't undermine the lust for material goods, which had appeared strongly in the Brezhnev period, which you say maybe is a natural part of human nature. I agree. But which, if it's individualistic in nature, if it depends on connections, I know somebody who says that tomorrow there will be bananas, or I know somebody who says that one can get this at such and such. If it's not egalitarian, it's not really socialist. It's materialism that's individualistic and self-seeking. In other words, there was a kind of market mentality that developed under Brezhnev, developed still under Andropov. So despite his attempts to create ideological discipline, the tides of history were moving in another direction. In 1984, Mr. Andropov died of kidney failure. And Mr. Chernenko, who himself was extremely ill with emphysema, took command of the party. And Chernenko lasted only until 1985. Chernenko was a man of the nomenklatura, of the party apparatus. He was a perfect gatekeeper, that is, a second man. and he was styled by the jokesters in Moscow, who are generally right about such things, as Brezhnev's second man, an alter ego, or his shadow. There's a famous joke about Brezhnev looking into the mirror, and there's a sort of dual language pun here. Brezhnev looks into the mirror and he says, "Kostya, ya star," means Kostya, I'm a star, but star in Russian also means old. So he's saying, I'm a star, appropriated from the English, but also, I'm old. And Chernenko, who is always standing there behind, said, "Нет, Леня, ты не стар, ты суперстар. You're not just old, you're very old. Or you're not just a star, you're a superstar." Well, anyway, you get the point of how Chernenko was understood by the Muscovite wags. Chernenko halted the anti-corruption drive that Andropov had begun. And the reason he did it is that it was aimed at lower-level people like himself. Chernenko was a man of the apparat, of the nomenklatura, and he was going to defend his like. Chernenko, like Andropov, pursued a rather bellicose-sounding foreign policy. They continued the war in Afghanistan. 1983, the Korean airliner flight, the commercial flight made a sensation at the time, was shot down by Soviet military at the Isle of Sakhalin. There was a linkage between the hardline foreign policy, the anti-Western sentiments, the bellicosity abroad, and domestic policy. Under Chernenko, for example, old Stalinist laws against fraternization with foreigners were evoked and enforced from time to time. So I remember colleagues of mine who had thought nothing about visiting Soviet homes and having dinner there and getting drunk and sometimes spending the night in wild parties or learned conversations around the kitchen table. These people were suddenly afraid for themselves, afraid for their friends, because they feared arrest for the one or the other. Dissidents, such as Roy Medvedev's brother, Roy Medvedev, were warned to stop publishing things of a certain type. Roy Medvedev had written a book called Before the Court of History. It's translated in English as Let History Judge. And it is a very anti-Stalinist book based on some archives to which he was given access through behind-the-scenes maneuvers. And he wrote other books, one a rather favorable book about Nikolai Bukharin. It was considered by Chernenko that these books were too anti-Stalinist, too pro-reformist or liberal in terms of the Communist Party, and so Medvedev was asked to cease and desist making such publications. Well, when Chernenko died in 1985, the Soviet Union had experienced the death of three general secretaries in almost as many years. Brezhnev died in 82, Andropov 84, Chernenko 85. This was the same generational cohort. These people at the end of their lives were obviously physically not up to the task. Finally, the conclusion was drawn that it was time to let power rest on the shoulders of a younger person. And this mantle, this heavy responsibility, fell on Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev. Gorbachev was born in 1931. He was not a part of the Brezhnev generational cohort. His family is a Cossack family that had been involved in agriculture in the 30s under collectivization. His family had suffered during collectivization. His paternal grandfather was arrested and did 9 years in a Stalinist prison camp. Gorbachev, we don't know what subjective conclusions he drew immediately from this. Perhaps it rankled him, and later on it became the seed of his reform communism. A very good journalist like Dusko Doder of the Washington Post speculated about this. Who knows? Gorbachev didn't serve in the war. He went to university after the war, 1950. He entered Moscow University, and he took a rather unusual for the time course of study. He studied law. Imagine studying law under Stalin. Solzhenitsyn dismissively says in the Gulag, there was no law under Stalin. Of course, there were prison codes. There were lots of laws, but he means not in the sense of of a recognizable, stable set of rules that applied to everybody in society. Well, Gorbachev studied law, and this decision enabled him to study the history of political thought. It's one of the few courses of study in the Soviet Union under Stalin that would have necessitated familiarity with Machiavelli, Hobbes, Locke, Montesquieu, Hegel, and so on. So Gorbachev, although he was nominally a Stalinist at this point, wasn't everybody, was nevertheless, maybe against his own desires, learning about alternative ways to contemplate politics. Gorbachev was a son of the Khrushchev reforms in party terms. He got his first jobs under Khrushchev. The first party congresses that he attended were under Khrushchev. In 1961, he voted in support of the removal of Stalin's body from the mausoleum. He listened to Khrushchev's long speech, and from what we know, he endorsed it. Russians have a word, gibki chelovyek, and it means flexible. There's a little intimation of dishonesty or slipperiness. We have a slick somebody in office now these days in Washington. Gorbachev was slick and then some, because this reform communist was on good terms with Chernenko, good terms with Brezhnev, and very good terms with Andropov. In fact, it is through Andropov's patronage that Gorbachev came from the south, from the Stavropol Krai, or Stavropol region, where he was the regional secretary, came to Moscow. He was given the worst imaginable portfolio for a young member of the Central Committee and an up-and-coming party person. He was put in charge of agriculture. Oh, my Lord. What is a mother to do with agriculture? Gorbachev had a track record as an agricultural reformer, but the thing is, you can't draw any conclusions about his style of leadership from this track record, because he tried various sorts of innovations. On one farm, he had a super centralized administration, and he looked at every detail. On another farm, he experimented with a sort of semi-market stimulus system where peasants, if they had a certain output, would get rewarded with a higher wage. Both of these systems seem to work. I draw the conclusion from this that essentially Gorbachev was an improviser. He wasn't an ideologue in the Leninist sense, in the Stalinist sense. He didn't think that a given model of agriculture was the way it had to be. He was flexible. Гибкий такой человек, a flexible sort of guy who was looking for the kind of thing that worked best and was having his eye pointed to the bottom line. Now, between 1985 and 1987, Gorbachev was feeling his way. He had, first of all, to wait for death and disability to take the bodies of some of the Brezhnev holdovers away. He appointed people of his own generation. Some of them were wise appointments, some not. Under him, for example, Yeltsin came to the Politburo of the party. Under him, Fyodor Ligachev, who would end up being his enemy, came there, and so on and so forth. He began, as he gradually felt his power consolidating, to speak the language of reform. He started to speak about perestroika, which means rebuilding. Stroika is from the Russian verb stroits, to build, and pere means to do it again. So reconstruct, rebuild. He talked about rebuilding the system. Now, this wasn't a new term. It had been heard in the 19th century when the authorities contemplated the abolition of serfdom. It had been heard under Stalin in 1952, strangely enough. When I was in the Soviet Union in 1986, a friend of mine pulled a trick on me. She said, I'm going to read you something from the general secretary of the party, and you just tell me when it's written. And she had a newspaper, and behind the newspaper there was a book I couldn't see. And she started reading a speech of Stalin to the 1952 Party Congress, and it sounded just like Gorbachev. And she said, well, who wrote this? I said, oh, well, this must have been Gorbachev. But when was it written? She says, no, guess again. I said, well, Khrushchev? She says, no, this is Comrade Stalin. Well, anyway, that was a moment in my political education that I'll never forget. So he used the term perestroika. He also talked about democratization. But remember, democracy in Soviet parlance meant something different than democracy in a Western context. It simply meant that more common people would get involved in things. So people in the Soviet Union, their ears ever attuned to new language, new words, and their content, were both interested in Gorbachev, but also mildly skeptical, wondering, well, will things really change? And I must tell you that the first program for perestroika, which Gorbachev articulated between 85 and 87, didn't promise very dramatic change. Let us talk about its tenets. First, Gorbachev said that the role of the central planners in the economy should be reduced. Now, what he had in mind was this. In the mid-80s, planners were fixing the prices of between 150 and 200,000 commodities. I've seen various estimates. I mean, can you imagine? It's a huge bureaucracy, and they're setting prices of pencils, prices of coffee, I mean, prices of capacitors, everything. Gorbachev thought this was excessive. He insisted that the central plan be revised so that only 1,500 essential commodities have their prices fixed and production quotas fixed by the state. Then, for the other commodities, Gorbachev said that prices should be set not by the central planners, but by negotiation between enterprises. So, if you're making steel widgets and you're supplying them to some military or some civilian factory, you work it out. Widgets cost this much or that much. Gorbachev spoke of the self-financing of enterprises. What that meant is, in theory, an enterprise would have to show a profit, or else it would close. Now, read the fine print. Defense industries weren't going to close because they were essential. But in principle, there was the rigor of the market system being talked about. Gorbachev said that the service sector of the Soviet economy was scandalously underdeveloped, and that therefore he was recommending that entrepreneurial freedom be granted to low-level service companies, which he didn't call companies, he called them cooperatives. Cooperatives were legally defined as enterprises with less than 18 workers and less than a certain income. After that, they fell under state ownership. So it was possible to run your own cab company, to open your own restaurant, and so on, under Perestroika at first. And then he spoke about limited democratization. What this meant was that in the context of the factory, workers could criticize management and foremen. They could recommend that some kind of way of making widgets was not working out and another way should be tried, and they wouldn't be punished for that. And he thought that workers ought to have more voice in the management of factories. He recommended experiments that workers might elect their own management. And he began to think about in low-level elections permitting multiple candidates. Now, this was only in 1987 was this suggested, and it was clearly a trial balloon. Internally, it seems to me, this Perestroika platform that he recommended was contradictory. It was contradictory for these reasons. If you set the prices of 1,500 commodities, suppose you set the price of steel, that's an input that's in every finished industrial good. What does a negotiated price mean in the context of state-owned enterprises? It's still the state that's setting the prices. It's just that you're saying now it's going to be done by this factory manager and that factory manager instead of this or that bureaucrat. What does greater democracy on the shop floor mean to the worker if, as Gorbachev always said in the fine print, if the party nevertheless has the final choice? This democratization, then, is very circumscribed in scope. How about entrepreneurial freedom? You have a corporation limited to 18 people. It's going to be a small corporation. You have to pay over 90% taxes. You're not going to have that much income to take home, not that much stimulus. If you have to apply for a license and you run into 6 months of headaches, it's a real pain. And then if you think back to the good old days, or were they the good old days of the new economic policy in the 20s, businessmen in the Soviet context didn't have a very propitious future. You had to have nothing to risk in order to be brave enough to be an entrepreneur in this environment. Surprisingly, many people, incidentally, had little to risk. So, for these reasons, and because Gorbachev kept insisting that all along this is true Leninism, these reforms never took. So Andropov, Chernenko, Gorbachev up to 1987, there was a fundamental continuity of problems and a fundamental continuity of failure in addressing those problems.